Let's go. Okay. House Committee on Revenue for May 8th, 2017 will come to order. Thank you, colleagues, for your promptness today. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3430. Yes, please. Go ahead and introduce the bill. We have three members who want to talk.
We're
not often this blessed. Give us a quick outline of the bill, and then we'll recognize them.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3430 directs that every other biennium, funds from unclaimed properties in the common school fund be distributed to school districts when the properties, unclaimed properties, are in the account for 25 years or more. We have -3 that replaces the original bill, and -4 makes it just one-time deal.
All right. Please.
Thank you.
Whoever would like to go first, and welcome to the your Committee on Revenue.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Chair Barnhart, members of the House Revenue Committee, my name is Janine Salmon. I am the state representative from House District 30, which represents areas of Banks, Hillsborough, North Plains, and Beaverton. I'm here today as the chief sponsor for House Bill 3430, which would allow money from the unclaimed properties account that is 25 years or older to be distributed to the 197 school districts from the Common School Fund. Currently, there is approximately $595 million of unclaimed property in the state of Oregon. Now, this money is from unclaimed paychecks, vendor rebate payments, like I found out my son has in there, and from people that maybe have passed away. They do not have kin or a will. The money sits in the fund and collects interest forever. And it's awaiting for someone to claim the funds. Interest that this fund accumulates is distributed to the Oregon Department of Education, and then it goes to the 197 school districts. If a person decides that after 25 years that they want to claim their property, they would still be able to do that, and it would come out of a revolving account that this bill would create. In the -4 amendments, the fund will take at least 1% of the disbursed money, put it into an account that would then be solely for disbursement of funds 25 years or older. Just to give you an idea that last year, the money that was claimed that was over 25 years old was totaled about roughly $50,000. So this idea came to me through the lens of an 8-year Hillsborough school board member, knowing that funding proposals that have come forward indicate that we are far from the $9.97 billion target of the quality education model. And in Hillsborough, we recently approved a budget that includes $7.5 million in cuts. Since 2008, we've cut $65 million from our Hillsborough school board budget. This bill would invest an approximate amount of $26 million that would be used directly in our classrooms for January 2018. This could mean one whole day of school for our state. Now, in a state that has one of the shortest school years and largest class sizes, every day of instruction matters. I understand that there are concerns about shrinking the overall corpus of the fund, but as you can see from the charts that I think will be shown that the fund will still grow by over $100 million in the next biennium, and a one-time disbursement will not cause the Department of State Lands to adjust their distribution policies to meet the needs of future generations. When we came into this session, we all knew the budget shortfall that we were facing and difficult choices that need to be made. House Bill 3430 is an out-of-the-box method of finding one more school day for our kids, and I look forward to working with each and every one of you to move this bill forward.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Rich Vile, House District 26, Shoals-Sherwood, Wilsonville, and South Hillsborough. I am just flattered that Representative Solman allowed me to join her as a sponsor on this bill. It's a brilliant idea. The Vile family had a had an extended birthday bash last night where we had a number of folks there. We totaled up about $2,900 among us as we looked online to see who had money sitting in the account. We all decided we'd just let it sit there. It only averaged about $130 for any one person. The great thing about this is it really doesn't change anything that's occurring today. The fund continues to grow. The unclaimed property fund continues to grow so that the interest on it continues to be distributable. This $26 million is really more or less an extra cherry on the tree that allows us to be picked and used for a very, very good purpose at this time. So I'd urge an aye vote on this bill.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, committee. David Brocksmith, State Representative, House District 1, Charleston to Brookings, over to West Cave Junction, up to West Roseburg, and back over lots of school districts. And I'm also a Port Orford Langlois school board member and have been for going on 8 years, I believe. I am too flattered that good representative allowed me to join her in chief sponsoring this legislation. It is, in fact, out-of-the-box thinking, which is what we need in this legislative session. And this will benefit school districts for years to come. But currently, it'll benefit school districts in my jurisdiction, especially in counties that, of course, are severely hurting, and such that the Coquille School District will receive an extra $19,000. Which will be very beneficial through their budget cuts, and the combined Douglas County School District, $250,000. All in all, $600,000 will be allocated through this legislation to all of the districts within my House District. And all of these districts are, of course, part of the rural Oregon that is in dire need of these type of revenues. And so I respectfully request the committee support. This is the type of thinking that we need in this legislature, in my opinion, to move things forward. So happy to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I'll note for the new members that we're going to hear from Jim Paul, the director of the Department of State Lands, to help describe what this fund is and how it works and what this proposal actually does operationally. So if you'll hold technical questions for him, questions for this panel, though. Thank you. Oh, yes. Do you want to add something?
I do, Mr. Chair. I just want to emphasize what has already been discussed with regards to this is an initial $26 million that will be distributed. But as it was stated before under testimony, the Common School Fund, or this unclaimed property fund, is always being replenished every year. And so what comes off is being added on and so forth. So,
thank you. Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank all of you, particularly Representative Solman, for bringing this forward, because it really is one of those things that it just it's such a simple idea, and you have been extremely responsive going through the process of when concerns have been brought up. And I just want to point out there is such confusion about the state school fund versus the common school fund. We have another issue before this committee where, indeed, when the marijuana legalization ballot measure passed, they wrote it in that money would go to the common school fund, not understanding that the common school fund was not actually going to do with that money what they thought it would. And so one of the things we've talked about in here is needing to move that language to the state school fund. So I just think it's a great idea to take that and move it to a place where it can be better and more and utilized now. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, freshman legislators. I appreciate Representative Solman for bringing this forward and asking me to sponsor it. This bill would bring in over $1.5 million to the four school districts that reside in my district. district. So I really do appreciate the innovative thinking, and there was no question, just the comment, Chair.
Yes, please.
Can I respond?
Yes, please.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I know that being a school board member, that you were excited about this opportunity to sign on. There was some, the Department of State Lands looked at some figures. We initially had thought it was $22.5 million, which, mind you, we were extremely excited about. But after looking further into this, it's $26 million. So for your school district, and we do have calculations for each and every one of you, for your school district, it's nearly $2 million. It's 1.9. So, and for instance, Chair Barnhart, the accumulation for all your districts, it's nearly 1.4 million. So, significant, and
keep,
I have these. I can
keep going.
Yeah.
What about Representative Vance?
Representative Vance, $354,000. I know. Barr Smith Warner, $3.3 million. Representative Bueller, $751,000, actually over that amount. Mentioned Diego. Mentioned Representative Johnson, $1.1 million. Representative Marsh, nearly $825,000 for your three districts. And Representative Nose, $2.2 million for Portland Public. And Representative Smith, over $503,000 for your districts. So wanted to provide that information.
Very good. Representative Vance, did you have something?
I did, Mr. Chair. I was just curious. I was looking at the Uniform Unclaimed Property Act, and I didn't want to have to do all the research. Have you guys already done that, and is this a common approach to unclaimed property across the United States?
So it has been done before. I mean, it's been done before, but the way it's been done, from my understanding, and I do have Hannah from the LC office as well as the folks from the Department of State Lands, but it's my understanding of what it has been is it's the, and I'm going to admit this is what I originally wanted to do, was that it didn't get used, so it was going to go to the schools, period, with not a chance for that revolving account in there. But that actually is turning to be unconstitutional. There's actually some states that are saying you can't just take it. There needs to be the ability to have people get their money if they would like it. So that's why we're taking the 1% of this fund. People can come and claim their money. Last year, of the amount I did mention, $50,000 was claimed in money that was over 25 years old. And also, I'm trying to work with the Department of State Lands on this. I really want to place some sort of disclaimer on the website that says if someone goes in to search their money, that has an amount that says this money was distributed to the 100 and, you know, the common school fund or your state school fund, because but they can still get their money. But this way they could say, you know what? My $35 went to schools. I feel fantastic. And they're just not going to go through the process. So I think that when people feel and look at this and say, you know what, this was invested in our schools and our future, I think that they're going to feel really good about that and not pursue it further.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. Right, of course, one might want to put a label on whatever it is we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
What would your label be? Are we borrowing the money? Are we stealing the money? Are we...
We're investing.
The money?
We're investing in my label. I believe it's an investment in schools because this money is in the account, and it has been untouched. Some of it's been untouched for, I think, 143 years. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, the reality is that we are borrowing the money with the possibility that it becomes a gift at some point. That's how the bill is currently written. And, for example, I mentioned the money that my family has there. We all sat around and said, well, let's just leave it there, and eventually it'll go to the schools, and we're not going to go chasing it. That, in that sense, it becomes a gift. But it is borrowed money because there is the possibility that at any time, under the way it's written, someone could come back and ask for the money that was over 25 years old and distributed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I would just add that was one of my concerns when we first discussed this piece of legislation, is how do you make sure that those resources, if in fact they were going to be claimed, can be paid. And I believe that with the amount of dollars that are coming in and the 1% allocation to cover those resources, because you still have 500 and
almost half, it's over half a billion.
You have, yeah, you still have half a billion dollars in the fund to cover the what might be claimed after 25 years.
Hold on.
That's advanced.
Right. So no matter which way we may choose to spin it, at best it's a loan, and then it's our taking somebody else's money, because we have all these processes, right? Probate and other things to make sure that ownership of property, and that must be what the constitutional issue is, and perhaps LC can opine upon this further, but it would seem to me that you never want these uncomfortable situations, sure, and this one's uncomfortable for the reasons we're all aware of. By the way, our current treasurer discussed this 8 or 9 years ago with me, am I right? And we stalled out on it, I think, mm-hmm, for this reason, but I honestly can't remember. Is that am I remembering that correctly?
I think so.
Yeah.
And
but again, it's not to say we can't do it. I think it's just a question of how. So
can I respond? Yeah. I do think that the way I was understood it before, that it didn't involve a revolving account, though, that could that is still available there. So it was set up, I think, originally as the money was just transferred to schools. So that's why we did place the revolving account, which would be, in there. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much. Very much appreciate your testimony.
Question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is there one more?
Sorry.
I'm sorry. All right, Representative Marsh and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
And I would like to get to Mr. Paul here pretty soon, because I think he'll be able to give us the answers to the technical questions. Please.
Thank you, Chair. And Mr. Paul may want to answer these. As I understand it, so we have $26 million that would be distributed. Mm-hmm. We would, the Dash 4 looks like it cuts off the program in 2021. Mm-hmm. So this is essentially a one-time distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Initially, did you
want to
go ahead?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative March, it's a trial balloon. Yes, it is sunsetting after 2 years, but the hope is that this would allow us to look at how this works and perpetuate it into the future.
So my follow-up, if I may, is I just wonder if you've thought about this in terms of, like, we had a committee come forward to set out some budget-making principles for us, and one of those was one-time money should be spent for unique purposes, not put into ongoing. So I wonder if you've thought about that in terms of school funding and whether there's some ways to apply that are in parallel with those budget principles.
I appreciate, thank you, Representative Marsh. I appreciate those that comment and the question. I really did look at this through the lens. I am not aware of that conversation, and mm-hmm, I really did come at this through the lens as a school board member and the cuts that we have faced. When we just adopt our budget, our school district budget the other night, and looking at the $7.5 million. So I think it's unique. It's unique that we don't fund our schools to the best of our, the what we need to do in this. We don't have the ability to do that. And I looked at this as a way to bring in those additional dollars to our district. You had said something prior to that. Oh, and I did also build into part of this having a report at the end of that before the four-year time, because I, from the Department of State Lands, to give the report, to give some understanding of how this has been affected, how it, how many people came in with the claim and so on and so forth, and troubles that they maybe had seen.
And I, Mr. Chair, Representative Marsh, I see this as a as not a one-time dollars, but as a perpetual dollars that we can, and as districts, look forward to. As Representative Vile said, this is just the trial balloon to make sure that all the processes will work. As a school board member, I would see, my district is only getting an additional roughly $8,000, which could be beneficial when it comes to our CTE programs, because we have difficulties with the bill that allowed, because we already had all the CTE programs. So I see this as not one-time dollars, but as the trial and then coming back in the 19 session and extending it again once we know that it's working.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Rep. Sullivan, for your passion here. I wonder, did you speak with LC about whether it'd be possible to distribute these funds directly through the formula rather than go through the Common School Fund? I just would want to resist the temptation for the Ways and Means process to utilize this to get to a specific number they're trying to accomplish over here. And I don't know whether that's could
Rep.
be
Johnson,
doable that way, but as a special dispensation or appropriation that just comes from this specific source.
Thank you, Rep. Johnson. Chair Barnhart, I appreciate that. I did not think of that, but I do think that's an interesting suggestion.
Okay. We can talk more about that.
Perfect.
Thank you. Did you want to add?
So, Rep. Johnson, this distribution will be considered as local revenue. So then it's going to be a part of money that will be distributed to all school districts and ESDs.
And this has to be that way, is what you're saying.
Yes.
It's so it
local
okay.
revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's Thank you. Part of local revenue. Yes.
Okay.
Just like the local property tax,
it would be,
and other things of this of similar sort.
Yes,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Our school board member knows about this stuff.
I know. That's why I'm saying that.
Yeah.
I want to take the cut the check to me.
Yeah.
Still good. Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson. We're going to definitely tease out that possibility, though, yeah. if we can get there with language.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony.
And please take a look. I do believe that some legislators that signed on as sponsors, they did provide written testimony
yes.
as well as yep, several of you on
it's
the...
It's in OLIS, and we appreciate
yeah,
that.
So thank you so much.
Thank you. Jim Paul, please. And anybody you'd like to bring with you. I know you're here as the director and may not have a specific position on it, but it would be, I think, useful for the members to hear the way this fund is set up, how the fund, the part that includes unclaimed property is managed, and where that money goes, and where the income on that money goes, and how it's managed, since I think some of us here probably don't know those things. And then if you have further things to say about the bill, I'd appreciate that, too.
Sure. Well, thank you, Chair Barnhart, and good afternoon, committee. Happy to be here. Happy to review that information and answer any questions that I can for you today regarding unclaimed properties. I'll get a quick history or background. The unclaimed property program came to the Department of DSL in the 1950s. What we do is essentially hold all monies that belong to Oregonians that are unclaimed. We are charged with holding those monies in perpetuity for those Oregonians until they are claimed or until their rightful heirs come forward to claim those monies. The fund, I would say, was relatively small up until about 10 or 15 years ago, due to changes in demographics, due to changes in state and federal laws, various reasons. We've seen acceleration and uptick in terms of the amount of unclaimed properties that comes to our department, comes to the Common School Fund to manage. And it is currently at close to $600 million in value and is part of the entire Common School Fund, which is a total of about $1.5 billion. So the difference there of that other $900 million is essentially monies that have been accumulated over time through the sale and management of school trust lands that were provided to the state of Oregon upon statehood under the Oregon Admissions Act. So those monies all combined are managed under a single fund by the Oregon Investment Council under the Treasury, Department of Treasury. Those funds have been managed in a portfolio. The modern-day portfolio inception was 1995, and that fund has hovered right around 7.25% since inception. We see that number change a little bit every quarter, but it seems to be hovering right around there. Currently, when we look back at our three-year average amounts in terms of unclaimed property coming in versus the amount of claims that we send out, we have been bringing in about $60 to $70 million a year, and we've been putting out about half of that. So our average net income from unclaimed properties that has that stays in the fund in a given year has been around $33 million. And again, those monies are, as I've said, intended and our charge is to hold them in perpetuity for their rightful owners or rightful heirs. We go through a process of a notification process to let Oregonians know that they may have unclaimed property. We have a website that's very easy to access and get to, and you can look up whether you might have any in a matter of minutes. So we do our best, and that is the charge. It is essentially, the way I phrase it, is a consumer protection program. You know, our first and foremost purpose is to return those monies to the rightful Oregonians. And to the extent we aren't able to be successful in that, then they sit in the fund and they generate revenue for the Common School Fund. The revenue that's generated is part of multiple factors that the Oregon State Land Board has to take into account when they are determining and charging the department with implementing their distribution policy for the Common School Fund. So their distribution policy looks back at the total fund value average over the last 3 years and has us distribute either 4% or 5% a year, depending on the performance of the fund in the last 3 years. And that distribution policy and assumptions are all based on what we can estimate and predict around inputs and outputs going into that fund. So we update that policy about every 7 years. We're actually right in the process of about updating it now. But that's where the land board's role plays into this amount. Otherwise, these dollars and these funds within the department, we term them statutory dollars because the department is charged to manage these dollars through statute, and the land board is charged with overseeing the department in doing our duties in terms of managing those dollars. With that, I have provided some written testimony to you, and I'll reiterate that the department does not have a position on the bill, but there are kind of three key pieces, I think, in this testimony I would just point to. The first is really around implementation. So we've worked and been communicating with Rep. Solomon's office a number of times just around looking at the implementability and what it would take for the department to do this. And we believe she and her staff have worked diligently to ensure that regardless of any other issues and policy sort of decisions and choices and trade-offs, at least in terms of if this were to be in place, would it be implementable, we believe it can be. Another thing I would say is that this is based primarily on the Dash 3 amendments. This was prepared Friday before the Dash 4s and 5s came in. So it is there's some language in here that's specific to the Dash 3s before the sunset clause essentially came into play. I believe it's in the Dash 4s, yes. The second piece of the testimony just points out that the bill does pose potential liability exposure, as you've heard discussed just previously amongst the testimony, and that really emanates from Article, I can read my Roman numerals, Article 11, Section 7 of the Oregon Constitution, and this is around creating any debt or liability for the state. I think fundamentally, so there are varying legal interpretations of the section. Again, we've shared this information with Rep. Solomon, and she's had her staff look at this issue. There are very varying interpretations, but fundamentally the question is around the entire amount. Does the entire amount need to be maintained over time for potential claims? And if it is distributed, does the state need to hold back some other monies in order not to be potentially liable for those monies? Or, in fact, is the scheme that this bill proposes around having a revolving account for the likely claimants to come through, does that satisfy that issue and that potential legal risk? And I won't try to play lawyer and opine on that for you today, but that's fundamentally the issue, and I would defer to knowledgeable attorneys to give advice and weigh in on the different arguments on that issue. Finally, the last paragraph in the testimony points out what you've already what's already been mentioned: the $26 million in distribution that this would trigger, which would cause a change in the annual earnings of about $1.7 million. So I think this just points out one of the fundamental sort of policy questions here is to have a $26 million today or $1.6 million per year perpetually. And that's that's one of the fundamental issues around that's raised there. The last statement in there that says subsequent distributions are estimated to be similar in magnitude and have a similar effect on annual earnings and reduced growth in the principal balance of the common school fund. That again was under the dash 3 version where it did not post a sunset, but if it were to continue, there would be a comparable reduction in the corpus of the fund if the bill did not sunset. So that would be another factor that would have had to be considered. With that, I'll stop and be happy to answer any questions.
Let me ask a couple technical questions and then we'll see if there are others. When a person makes a claim and you refund, you pay out dollars that you've been holding in trust, what do you pay out? Do you pay out the amount plus interest? Do you pay out just the amount that was originally deposited? What's the plan? What is it?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, we pay out just the amount that was originally deposited. The statutes allow the department to, that is the liability. It was the original amount, and any interest earned on that is the state uses. We use first to fund the program, to fund the work that we do, and then after that, it gets factored into the growth of the Common School Fund.
And what happens to that growth? The Common School Fund. Does it all stay in the fund, or does some of it get distributed?
So, Chair Barnhart, it all stays in the fund, and again, we continually track over time that growth. That's one of the inputs of growth to the fund to ensure that the Land Board's distribution policy that essentially distributes as much of those monies as they can while still staying in compliance with their fiduciary duty of the Common School Fund. And that fiduciary duty holds that there has to be intergenerational equity. So the benefits to today's school children have to be similar in kind to the benefits that the future school children will see, and vice versa. So you can't over-distribute today and under-distribute the future, and or vice versa. So they are constantly, as I said, we review that policy about every 7 years or so to ensure that we are both modeling forward and looking back and making sure that we are essentially keeping the common school fund constant in real dollars. So even though it grows with inflation, it gets a ideal as a flat line real dollar so that the fund is worth the same in the future as it is today.
Worth in inflated
in
dollars?
Inflated dollars.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right. And so where does the money go when you distribute it?
So when we distribute the monies, it goes into the it gets equally distributed proportionally to all 97 school districts. So for this biennium, we estimate a total of $136 million will have been distributed over the course of the 2 years. And it's distributed proportional to the school age, the population of school age children, which is defined between ages of their population between 4 and 20 years, I believe. And don't ask me where that metric came from, but that's the metric that we use that the law requires.
Is that the local revenue you were referring to?
Yes, sir.
It is. So this would be an addition. If this bill were to pass, there would be at least that one-time addition to the amount you were just describing, and then there would be a reduction of $1.7 million in future distributions, because, or at least in future earnings, that lead to distributions, because that money would not be there to earn that $1.7 million. Is that a reasonable summary?
Yes, that is a reasonable summary.
Thank you.
Yes.
Other questions? Thank you, Representative Bannon.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The rate of return then? What's the rate of return that results in that $1.7 million?
The rate of return is, we assume, is 6.5%. And the basis of that is actually, I mentioned in my earlier that we are currently undergoing a review of the distribution policy through the Treasury Department. There is a consultant that is working on this, and that's the number that they are using in their modeling, which is how we arrived at that number.
Thanks. Yes.
So is the amount that that's the wrong way to put the question. Those amounts that are currently ending up with you come from, since the last 12, 15 years, we can anticipate all kinds of different sources, but you must be able to look at those sources and identify the most likely. The likelihood of the continuation of those kinds of default arrangements. Can you predict how much is going to be coming in each year based upon just looking at the type of accounts that are falling into your hands?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bence, you know, it's actually really difficult to predict that. We cannot actually, with a high level of confidence, even though we don't see very often abrupt shifts. Occasionally in a year, we will see a pretty big shift up or down, but generally we'll see just moderate sort of changes up or down. It's so dependent on demographics. It's so dependent on any changes in the federal or state law level around what is or isn't unclaimed property. It's dependent, too, on how much is claimed in a given year. So especially looking out, trying to predict what the 25-year or more number is so dependent on how many claims come in the first 25. It is very difficult to predict. I think just based on past performance, it'd be very unusual to see a big change in any given year or two. But we could see the trend go in ways that doesn't necessarily track population growth, doesn't necessarily track economic growth.
One last question. There's a huge incentive for us not to look very hard for those who actually have the money because of the income that it throws off to our schools. But how much do we spend actually trying to find people?
I would need to get back to you on that number. I don't have that number off the top of my head. It would essentially be our program costs, and I could get that number for you and follow up with the committee with that number. It's in probably the millions of dollars a year. We have a staff of 13 people that do the work, this work, and we have stayed at that same staff level for about the last 10 years, even though claims have, I believe claims have close to doubled. We've automated a lot of our systems, gone from paper to electronic, so we've tried to actually keep our costs low despite the growth in that part of our work.
Yep.
Just a comment. I know in our state planning and probate administration department, we have this, of course, as a common or required search when people come in who have passed away, and we look. But over the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of people who have multiple accounts, and it has a lot to do with the demographic you're talking about, particularly World War II generation folks who are very worried about putting everything in one place. And when they come in, they forgot about. So I was just wondering if that demographic, if that didn't lend itself to some prediction, but mm-hmm. I understand your point. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Just one more thing, Mr. Chair. So that 1.6 or 1.7 million that is distributed annually wouldn't go away. It just would potentially be reduced, correct? Because the corpus would be less.
So that 1.7 is an estimate of the reduction in annual interest the fund would earn in total, essentially taking that $26 million that would have been there.
Well, you're basing that off the expected return?
Based on an estimated 6.5% return.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Very much
thank
appreciate
you.
Your testimony and the clear explanation of the work that you do. Appreciate it. John Hayes, Nancy, McManus, Eddix, perhaps?
I want to sit here.
Okay. Great. And if you'll state your name for the record and then give your testimony, we'd appreciate that.
You can go first.
I can go first. Sure. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chairs Benz and Smith Warner, members of the committee, my name is Nancy McMorris Oddix. I am the current chair of the Salem Kaiser School Board. I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 3430. Thank you for the opportunity to address this important issue of school funding. I've served on the Salem Kaiser School Board for the past 8 years. We're currently in the midst of our budget deliberations, and again, we're making cuts. This year, we're faced with a $21 million hole. I will conclude my service to the district on June 30th of this year, and during my 8 years, I will have voted on 6 budgets with significant cuts. We no longer have teacher librarians. We've cut school counselors. We've cut CTE programs. Our class sizes are too big. We have always cut administration and support services first, but we have not always been able to protect the classroom. Again, this year we are cutting. We're eliminating 25 elementary teaching positions and 13 positions at both middle school and high school. Our class sizes have to come down. Your colleague, Representative Brian Clem's third grade daughter, is in a third grade class in my district with over 30 other students. This compromises the quality of her and her classmates' education. I could go on about the consequences of this budget, particularly after years of cuts. I know you're aware of the crisis facing school districts around the state and have seen the great visuals from COSA and OSBA on the impacts of different budget levels on your local districts. Salem-Keizer budgeted at $8.1 billion. We've been saving for the PERS increase, so we have some reserves to help defray the costs of the increases, and we will still cut $16 million. If, and that's a pretty big if these days, the governor's budget passes. The co-chair's recommendation means even bigger cuts. I did not run for school board to slash our schools to the bone. I'm an ardent advocate for public education as the means for every child in our community to have an opportunity to attain their dreams, whether that be a great job, a technical education, or college. So this work has been personally defeating. We know what needs to be done to make all kids successful. We don't lack the knowledge or the desire. We lack the resources. This bill is a small but needed idea to bring dollars to our schools. If House Bill 3430 passes, Salem-Keizer will get approximately $1.8 million of that, as we get about 7% of all state schools' allocations. That money can cut our elementary teacher reductions by 72%. Lowering the elementary class size for more than 550 students. I strongly urge you to pass this bill, as it has no downside. Property that is unclaimed for over 25 years has been abandoned. This revenue can help shore up schools throughout our state. Please pass House Bill 3430. Thank you for this opportunity to address this creative approach.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you. I'm John Hayes, Forest Grove School District, which includes all of Forest Grove, some outlying areas, and about half of Cornelius. I've served on the board for 5 years. My first year on the board, I was appointed because of a recall in Forest Grove because of school cuts, surprisingly. In my 5 years on the board, I've served 2 years as chair and 2 years as vice chair, and I've come down to Salem more than 20 times to talk to various bodies and legislators about school funding. And I'm hoping for the day when I can come down here and thank you greatly for straightening out the school funding thing, and I know that you're working very hard for that. So. My comments are these. As the vice chair of the Forest Grove School District Board of Directors, I am testifying in favor of HB 3430, a bill that would distribute unclaimed funds that have been in the Common School Fund for 25 years or more. While the legislature seems to be making progress on a combination of tax reform and reduction in spending growth that would benefit schools, we know all too well that nothing is guaranteed. If we end up with funding at the governor's proposed $8 billion state school fund, the Forest Grove School District would be faced with $1.5 million or 2% in cuts to its annual budget. If the state school fund ends at the co-chair's working number of $7.8 billion, we would have to cut $3.5 million or 5% of the budget. I probably do not need to spell out how damaging and unacceptable those cuts would be. This would come at a time of 4% unemployment and record state revenues. News reports that booming state revenues might trigger the individual income tax kicker make the situation look increasingly dire for our schools. While HB 3430 would not add a great deal of money to the Common School Fund, we who serve districts around the state are looking for any funds, no matter their size, to help us avoid some of the cuts that we face. On behalf of the state's school children, I ask you to pass HB 3430. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate it very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3430 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2086.
Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2086, you have two versions. One is the introduced version, which is authorizes a governing body of our local government to notify governor when the local government is insolvent. It goes through and defines a criteria for insolvency, authorizes the governor to establish a fiscal emergency oversight board, and then it directs the fiscal emergency oversight board to prepare a plan to resolve the local government's state of fiscal emergency. In the material, you have some background on House Bill 3453, which passed in 2013, and that became Chapter 753 in 2013 laws. And so that's, I put that into OLIS as well, so you can see the reference to Chapter 753. The dash one essentially replaces the introduced version of the bill. It removes the sunset, which is in Chapter 753, which is the public safety emergency process that was established by the legislature in 2013. So it removes that sunset in existing law, and then it adds a section in which it says a tax or assessment may be imposed under the sections of 753 upon the taking effect of an ordinance adopted by the governing body of the county. So it modifies the process for 753, and then it eliminates the sunset, which is due in 2018.
Great. Thank you so much. We have several witnesses today. Let's hear from Rob Bovet and Oren Hacker, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel Association of Oregon Counties, here in support of House Bill 2086. I'm largely going to turn it over to Oren here to kind of walk you through the bill, but first a couple of preliminary comments. Indeed, as staff mentioned, we have the 2013 House Bill 3453 framework, which addresses fiscal distress related to public safety in counties only. Dash one amendments would, in fact, repeal the sunset. I believe the other provision mentioned is just a conforming amendment to conform ORS 203 to that bill. But I'm going to make that moot by telling you that we're no longer interested in pursuing the dash one amendments because we have a new bill, House Bill 3434, that takes care of that, which had a good hearing in House Rules, and hopefully that moves forward to allow for continuation of that tool in the toolbox for counties, specifically in public safety fiscal distress. So back to the bill on its merits. We introduced, we are in the minority in Oregon in terms of not allowing this type of structure for answering fiscal distress of municipalities. Most states have something like this on their books. So the last full session we introduced a bill, House Bill 3518, had a hearing on it in House Rules. It was our first kind of stab at it. Oren and I sat down and looked at other states, conformed it to Oregon's reality, and produced that bill. We took a lot of feedback from 2015 House Bill 3518 and took care of what we thought were all the expressed concerns at that time and prepared what is in front of you, House Bill 2086. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Oren, and he's going to walk you through in eight quick slides functionally what House Bill 2086 does.
Well, excuse me, Representative Barnhart and members of the House Revenue Committee, thank you for having me here today. Let me dive right in.
And for the record, your name is?
Oren Hacker. I'm a partner with the law firm Stoll Reeves.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Sure. Okay, so in terms of, I sort of wanted to take a step back and just deal with the bill from both a public policy and sort of a general theme perspective. The bill is really designed to do three things. One, it's to identify fiscal distress, which we call insolvency here, and I'll talk a little bit about what kind of insolvency this bill is designed to address in our local government entities as quickly as possible. The second is to provide a mechanism or process for investigating the distress, proposing a solution to resolve the distress, and then implementing the solution. Now, proposing solutions and implementing solutions that require multiple parties to appear at a negotiating table can be difficult. And this bill is specifically designed to bring everyone into one room and work out a deal to whatever problem the municipal entity is dealing with. The third, and this is only when necessary, it's to implement the creative solution through the bankruptcy court. And I want to talk a little bit about that, too, as we sort of dive in here. And I'm going to switch to the next slide. So currently there's no statutory mechanism in Oregon to effectively and collaboratively respond to fiscal distress. As we all know, state law is cabined in dealing with this kind of distress by the constitutional prohibition on impairment of contracts. And I think, as we all know, impairment is a sensitive word. Different people view impairment differently, and everyone's entitled to their opinion. But the idea of resolving financial conditions through state law mechanisms is difficult, often results in a lot of time spent, investment from everyone here and in other parts of the state, and often results in folks ending up in court. HB 2086 is designed to deal with this in part, and it sets forth a process through the creation of the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board to bring taxpayers, creditors, retirees, public employees, and the state to the table to resolve the fiscal distress. The board steps into the shoes of local leaders to investigate problems and propose solutions for the particular municipal or special purpose entity. And I want to stop here for a minute and focus on this concept of a board, because I think there are two benefits here. One is, and you see this in other states that don't take the board approach. They take an individual approach, i.e. a receiver type approach. The benefit of a board is, frankly, it's more democratic. If you have one person who steps in, you have the problem of capture. That person has biases. That person has preferences. I don't want to refer to them as weaknesses, but I think by having a board as the entity, and the bill doesn't say it has to be 3 members or 5 members or 7 members or 9 members. It can be a board of 3 if that's the appropriate, if all you need are 3 people to represent the interests of the municipality, depending on what the issue is. The second piece is the board essentially steps into the shoes of local leaders, which resolve some of the political pressures that often prevent real solutions from being proposed and implemented. I an analogy here, and it was a couple of cases I was very much involved in, is, and the analogy is to what the federal government did in 2008 and 2009 when General Motors and Chrysler went bankrupt. President Obama came in, and he appointed an auto task force. And it was a task force of independent, non-political people who understood what financial distress was, understood the issues. It was a mixture of lawyers, investment bankers, and other individuals, union officials, who came together and were and the U.S. Treasury essentially delegated authority to them, and they put together restructuring plans for the auto industry. So that's the concept here. And essentially all the parties that are affected by this distress negotiate against a backdrop of bankruptcy. And what does bankruptcy give here? I mean, why even have it in this bill? Well, it gives a municipal employer the power to restructure existing contractual obligations through a plan of debt adjustment pursuant to the bankruptcy code. It increases the municipal employer's leverage to get a deal done. And ultimately, that's what this bill is all about. It's about affecting leverage. Let me move to the next slide, if I may.
Excuse me just a moment. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is taking back, me back to my bankruptcy days in foreclosing on various things. And we always viewed bankruptcy as the final card to be played.
Of course.
But that's not necessarily the case with municipalities. So can you tell everybody what that final card is for a municipality? If not bankruptcy, what? Can you describe, what's that baseline we measure everything else against?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great question, Representative Bentz, and let me try to answer it. There is no, I think what you're also getting at is there's no liquidation
right.
in municipal distress. Really, the base, you know, the sort of worst case scenario without it is essentially a zombie government. Right. I mean, when we talk about what is insolvency, and it sort of gets to, I think, my next slide here, it is a government that really doesn't function as a government, doesn't provide services, doesn't provide public safety, like public safety or other services. You know, there isn't a liquidation option. I sometimes look and see maybe if you sort of merge governments, there may be ways to address maybe duplication of government services by merging a village or a town or a city into a county. So there are, I think, sort of restructuring options that are very unique to municipal entities. But there is no liquidation, and really what there is just and I think there's in the sort of literature that's out there right now that talking about zombie governments. Governments that don't have budgets that are workable, that can't provide services. You have libraries closing. You have public schools strapped. Student-teacher ratios going, getting worse. I mean, there's all sorts of different, I think, effects of fiscal distress. One of the, I think, nuances here, and this bill, I think, is really good in that it defines what is insolvency, because you don't want to start this process unless you have to. And so it's very important to have the right kind of triggers here. And it's very important to identify when a problem is a problem that requires this kind of mechanism. But I think the answer is, there's no secured creditor taking back its collateral. That doesn't exist in this, and I don't want to draw analogies to certain other Chapter 9 events that have happened, whether it's Detroit or others, because I don't want to in any way suggest that we have a Detroit on our hands. That's not the point of introducing this. I think the point of this bill is the reason why we need it is we need a preventative mechanism here. It's one thing to to wait until there's an emergency, what do we do then? What do we do then? Because then you have a whole bunch of interested parties coming in with different realities, essentially. And so I think having a mechanism that is on the books and that is upfront and that is delineated and defined and doesn't pick winners or losers, that's key. The key here is this bill does not pick winners or losers. I don't know if that answers your question or if
it was a pretty good start, though. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, please go ahead.
So if we look at insolvency and what insolvency means here, it's not balance sheet insolvency. And that's the key. We're not looking at long-term liabilities and saying, well, this municipality is insolvent because its liabilities exceed its assets. That's not what is going on here. We're looking at what I'll refer to as equity insolvency, going concern insolvency, service level insolvency. And depending on the municipality or the special purpose entity, it's a test that is very fact dependent, and really that depends on the type of entity and the type of services that entity is tasked with providing. So I touched on this a little bit a couple minutes ago, responding to Representative Benz here. But in terms of the triggers, there are really just two triggers here. And the trigger isn't from Salem. The trigger is local government notifies the governor of the insolvency event, or a petition is signed by 5% of voters notifying the local government and governor of an insolvency event. That's the trigger. Very simple triggers. Coming from the municipality. what happens then? Let me switch to the... So as laid out in the bill, upon notification of fiscal distress, the governor must request information from the local government on its action plan for resolving the insolvency event. Local government, the local municipality must respond in writing within 45 days of the request for information or plan of action. And the governor, in consult with the Secretary of State and Treasurer, shall determine whether the local government needs state assistance to resolve fiscal distress and the insolvency event.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, excuse me, Representative Smith.
Thank you. Can we go back to the previous slide? So for me, as part of this conversation, the sticking point becomes point number three. And that is trying to determine what the level of fiscal assistance is. Because now if you go back to previous slides, you can go back two slides. Right there, failure to make payments to financial creditors, vendors, employees, and other creditors, that could become a significant financial issue, not only for the community or the local government, however it's defined, whether it's a special district, county, or city. But that could become a major issue for the state of Oregon to have to take upon itself.
Would you like me to respond, Representative Smith, or is that a...
Well, I guess it's more of a statement. To me, it's just fact.
Do you agree with that it's a fact, what he just stated?
Well, I think there is state involvement here. Certainly, and I think that's sort of the cost of sovereignty, right? The state has to be involved. I mean, it has political subdivisions, but the state ultimately needs to be involved in the solution.
So let me push back right
Please.
There.
Uh-huh.
Why? The state didn't create the problem. The local district did.
And what I'd like to avoid is well, I
and
guess
I'm
from...
not being argumentative.
Yeah, no.
Why? Why well, do we have to take that...
And I think depending on the problem, that might be true. But I think the state has to be part of the solution, even if it's only to oversee what the local government is doing to fix the problem. And what this bill does, it doesn't put the problem on the state. It allows the municipality, or it allows the governor, I should say, to appoint an oversight board that works with local officials to solve the problem.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I could agree if this was county-based only, but as soon as it becomes an issue of a special district within a county or a city within a county, I struggle to figure out the role the state needs to play in that. And I guess I just need to play through it more in my mind.
Great. So, well, that'd be an issue for us to consider. Representative Buehler?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. And maybe you can answer this question. It's related to the line of questioning from Representative Smith, and I've asked this now three or four times in the course of this session. If a city or county, for that matter, or transportation or transit district in the state of Oregon goes bankrupt, who ultimately holds the liability?
Well, it depends, and I don't want to be cute in answering it that way, Representative Buehler. The liabilities that the entity have are dealt with through a plan of adjustment, and we're assuming that there's a bankruptcy event, so that the municipality goes into bankruptcy court, and the liabilities are essentially restructured through a plan of debt adjustment that involves all of the creditors who are owed money, and taxpayers, residents, whatnot, employees. And the liabilities are essentially adjusted. So that could involve a write-down of the liability or a write-off of the liability. But I don't want to foreshadow where I think you're going with the question, but to the idea that the state assumes that liability, that's not what we're talking about. No.
But point.
This is the bankruptcy is the one example that Congress has the power to allow us to not fulfill our contracts. Mm-hmm. And that's when he's talking about debt adjustment, that's what he means.
That's exactly right, Representative Barnhart. The bankruptcy, the one exception to impairment of contracts in both the federal in both the United States in the federal contracts clause and the contracts clause that we have in our state constitution is the bankruptcy code, which is federal law, uniform law across the country, and that essentially exists for the purpose of impairing contracts. That's right.
So, point of clarification. So there is no risk for the state of Oregon to assume the liabilities from municipalities or counties in Oregon under current law?
No. And this bill, well, to the extent the liability that the county has, to the extent there is recourse to the state, that exists irrespective of this bill and irrespective of the bankruptcy code. The bankruptcy code does not shift liability from a debtor to another entity unless that other entity has existing liability under state law. So there is no federal court ability to shift the liability to the state.
Yeah, I get that. I'm still not,
sure.
You know, maybe take it down a level.
Sure.
So could you see a set of circumstances where the state of Oregon would have to assume liability for a Oregon municipality or county?
Under this bill?
No, just under current Oregon statute.
Well,
I think that may be a better question for LC or for LRO. It gets pretty complicated if you start thinking about legal liability, which I think is what you're asking about, versus the practical liability of making sure that things get done, like assessment and taxation, for example.
Yeah, I've been asked this question for about 4 months.
My frustration is I just
want to answer. I don't care if it comes from Oren here or if it comes from someone here, but I keep on asking the question, and I feel like I'm getting dodged, not you particularly, but I think we all need to know the answer to that question.
I agree.
And I think as it relates to this bill, there is nothing in this bill, and I'm not sure what the microphones were.
So you can move back.
Oh, okay.
If you get too close, it distorts.
This is a first for me. I don't do this every day. So,
right.
There is nothing in this bill that shifts liability from debtors, i.e., municipal entities, to the state, or frankly to anyone. If an entity has a liability. It has a liability after this bill passes. So,
got it.
Yeah. I can't speak to state law generally.
We're getting into part of a bigger debate. So.
Right. A whole different discussion. Representative Vance?
Yeah. I just think I want to state Representative Buehler's question perhaps in this fashion. I think what he may be driving at is the liability that may exist as a result of bonding mechanisms or other things of that nature where perhaps a municipality has drawn the state in already as a party to debt. And in that fashion, of course, if one goes bankrupt, then we would be holding the bag, but that's because of existing indebtedness arrangements such as bond arrangements. And that you go back and look at the indenture and find out where the heck you're at.
Yeah.
But as far as there being a constitutional obligation to step in and pick up the pieces when a municipality falls apart, there is none. I'm not sure that breaks it into as many pieces as exist, but perhaps that gets us closer to the answer.
Yeah, I would agree with everything Representative Benz just said there, yes.
Yep, please go ahead.
Okay.
Yes, that's where we were.
Yeah. Okay, so in terms of, what kind of cooperation can the state provide here once a fiscal distressed event occurs? And one is obviously advancing funds through loans, the terms of which would be worked out between the municipal entity and the state. The governor can also establish the board mechanism that we've talked about here, the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question right here?
And sure.
I think it's pertinent right here. So if the state can loan funds, why can't we control through a loan agreement, through a note, through a term business agreement, through all of those standard loan documents, how we want the special district, the city, whatever the entity is, to operate? Why do we have to create an oversight board? Why can't we just through contractual documents?
Nothing in this bill requires the state to do anything. And that's actually
a key point. I'm not trying to be argumentative. Then yeah. Why would we assume that liability?
There is no liability. Well, in terms of loaning funds, that is a may, not a shall.
But as soon as we prepare a plan of resolution, we leave ourselves susceptible to litigation.
It's not the state that's providing. Representative Smith, just
yeah,
to respond
correct
to
me
that.
Where I'm wrong here.
Okay. Yeah, no, I know the last thing I want to do is come across as...
You're good. We're good. We're really good here.
There is nothing in the appointment of a fiscal emergency oversight board is, you're correct, it's done by the state, but the state doesn't assume any liabilities or obligations of that board. The board essentially steps in to the local government and functions for a period of however long the state wants that board to function.
Let me ask one last question. I'll let it go.
Please. Uh-huh.
I'm a creditor, and Special District XYZ owes me money, and the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board comes in and takes over and begins to clean house, organize. As a creditor, I'm going to say, wait a minute, you're now controlling those operations, and now I'm going to litigate against that oversight board.
Mm-hmm.
At least I'm going to try to,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
I'm going to let a judge tell me no.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the language does it say that I can't do that?
Nowhere. And that's so let's play this out here. Creditor comes in, sends a demand letter, sends threatening letter to the oversight board, and says, you know, whatever it wants to say, right?
Sure.
They've just accepted an invitation to the table. Come sit down. Let's talk. Let's talk about what the problem is. Let's talk about what we're doing. And every other creditor that gets upset out there has just accepted an invitation to the table. And if the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board and the members can't work out a consensual resolution to the problem, they have the bankruptcy code as a backdrop. And every creditor in that room understands that the board has the bankruptcy code as a backdrop. And every creditor in that room should know, if they have good counsel, that in bankruptcy, a bankruptcy judge isn't going to respond to a holdout creditor, isn't going to respond to 10% of creditors who are holdouts. Under the bankruptcy code, you can essentially cram, and I hate using the word cram down because it has a confrontational connotation, but essentially you can cram down recalcitrant creditors. And frankly, upon filing for bankruptcy, let's say the county or the municipality was faced with 50 lawsuits. The minute that county determines that, you know something, I can't do it out of court, the creditors are too litigious and too unreasonable, the interested parties are not coming and negotiating in good faith, I file for bankruptcy, every litigation is stayed. It is an automatic stay. It's an injunction against any act against that county.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thanks. Please go ahead.
So in terms of what the board can do, and I think we just sort of walked through it in sort of a little bit of Q&A here, but the board, it shall be comprised of members with expertise in the areas relevant to the fiscal emergency. The bill is intentionally vague here. We can't foresee what's going to happen. We don't know who should be on each board or how big a board should be. So the bill punts on that. The board shall have the authority to run the affairs of local government. And may prepare a plan of resolution, and that plan of resolution may ultimately recommend that the municipality file a bankruptcy petition under Chapter 9. Chapter 9 is just, it's the chapter in the federal bankruptcy code specifically applicable to municipalities. So unlike Chapter 11, which is for corporations, or Chapter 7 or 13, which are for individuals, Chapter 9 is the bill for municipalities. Key takeaways here, and this is the last slide, and the cost of the process, the bill has the state assuming that cost. But I want to emphasize here, this isn't a bankruptcy bill. It is intended to provide municipal entities with the leverage to negotiate meaningful concessions from
Excuse me, just
all interested parties.
There,
yeah.
When you're done with this section.
Okay.
And the point here is there are no sacred cows. And then the last two bullets here really talk about Chapter 9, and I've stayed away from sort of walking through what a municipal entity's powers are in Chapter 9. I think it's fair to say that they're greater than they are without it. And when you look at the purpose of bankruptcy, it's to drive concessions from interested parties, creditors, and the like. It provides the municipal entity with breathing room to negotiate and to try to come up with a fair resolution that is fair to all parties. And, you know, one of the things that I often see in my practice and I think others do is that no one walks away from the table completely happy. But when no one walks away from the table completely happy, you probably got a fair solution. Lastly, and let me just make one final point here, and this is a point that Rob mentioned with his comments. There's a 10th Amendment issue here. You can't, you know, the reason why I think this bill is necessary is municipalities, other than irrigation and drainage districts today in Oregon, they have no authorization to file for bankruptcy. And that's because the Congress delegated that decision to the states. So if a state says yes, you know, my subdivisions can access the federal bankruptcy code under certain circumstances, then they can. And if a state is silent, they can't. So right now, about two-thirds of the states in the United States authorize in one form or another counties, cities, special purpose districts to file. Oregon is in the minority. Aside from irrigation and drainage districts, which for reasons that I have not been able to figure out, are authorized currently under current law to file for Chapter 9. There have been two bankruptcy cases in Oregon, both dating back to 1940. Those were, I believe, they were two irrigation districts. But I appreciate the time today, members, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
There already are some more. Yes, please.
Okay, so I'm truly just asking this. I don't want to be married to this position or this question. But you said there's no sacred cows, and that, you know, a good solution in this is one where all the parties are unhappy or something to that effect. So what about voters, residents of an area who consistently turn down levies, new taxes to fund services? Will this entity have the ability to levy taxes that voters have otherwise turned down?
Representative Noss, no. House Bill 2086 does not authorize the imposition of taxes separate and apart from any other legal authorization. So,
follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Please, Governor.
Okay, so I'm just going to say then that makes me anxious because you don't have all parties at the table, right? You have employees and contractors and other folks who have debt who they suffer all the loss, but the community either doesn't have to chip in to some aspect of that cost or maybe lose out on a service. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but in theory they've been voting to say, no, we don't care about that service. We're happy to let our libraries close and have a lawless, you know, have a few jails or a few, you know, I mean, so it's I'm concerned about a solution like this without the ability to have that board impose taxes, and I say that very carefully, not saying that I'm committed to that as a position, but I just think intellectually you don't have all parties there present if that's not one of the things that can be on the table.
If I may respond,
please.
There is nothing, and one of the certainly the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board could recommend to local leaders that a tax increase be part of the resolution or the solution, but that would have to go through. There's nothing in this bill that allows the board to impose that tax. But they...
One more follow-up. It's more of a statement, Mr. Chair. I guess I make the assumption that a local government has tried at various times to reveal to its the folks that they're governing that, hey, we're in trouble here, we need help, and for whatever reason, you know, those attempts have failed, and here we are.
Not done tomorrow.
And
if I could comment, Chair Barnhart and Representative Noss, I hear exactly what you're saying, and I happen to recall that you happened to be on the Rules Committee two sessions ago, and the prior iteration of this bill had something to that effect,
as well as
the concerns that we were trying to address in this bill. We heard concerns from a number of stakeholders, and so we rewrote this bill to address those concerns, and removing that was one of the primary concerns for this bill.
And just if I may add to that, I mean, one of the things that I look at when I look at how do you arrive at an effective resolution to any kind of problem like this, efficiency is key. Lack of litigation overhang is key. I mean, I see this in the private sector, and it applies, I think, equally in the public. And you don't want decisions that are made to be subject to years of litigation after those decisions are made. I can tell you that what has been well litigated throughout the country is the idea of passing a bill that authorizes municipalities to file. There has been litigation around that, and every time it's been rejected. It's constitutional. The U.S. Constitution allows for it. Federal Bankruptcy Code allows for it. But I think when you start getting into the area of having an unelected board have the authority to impose certain taxes on, on the community or just raise taxes, then I think you increase the risk of litigation.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Right, but I don't know.
Thank you. Representative Marsh, did you have a question?
I do have a question.
Please.
Thank you, Chair. If there is a sacred cow, I think it, in this whole debate, I think it's elections and ensuring at a time of great transition that elections move forward and smoothly. I know the state has the ability to step in and help fund local elections if a county isn't able to do that. At the same time, this language gives this board some pretty broad powers and notes that consent of the governing body of the local government is not required for the board to act, at least in some context. So I wondered if you considered putting in some language around elections and the to ensure us that in a time of this kind of transition that elections go forward as scheduled.
And Chair Barnhart and Representative Marsh, let me tackle that in two ways. First, should note that obviously the trigger starts with the governing body of the entity, and of course then you can do what you've just described. But keep in mind that in Oregon, county clerks are the ones that actually run elections mm-hmm. in Oregon. But of course, if we have a county in fiscal distress, that separate elected official, the county clerk, might not have any money
right.
because the county hasn't allocated it. So that would be a matter of how does the Secretary of State find funding to continue to operate the elections, either through this board process or separately from that. But and let me state just generally, because I know you may hear some additional concerns from other folks, and that's fine and great. We are not set on any of the language in 2086. We're trying to find something that all the stakeholders can live with. So we are more than open to working with anybody on amendments to this bill. We just strongly feel that this tool needs to be in the toolbox in Oregon law.
Can I ask a second?
Please.
Uh-huh. Not a follow-up, but a different question that you prompted. I don't see anything in the record that from LOC or any of the Special District Association. Have you worked with other public entities on this yet?
Representative Barnhart and Representative Marsh, I believe you're going to hear from LOC shortly.
Okay.
So I think they might have some concerns. I think the State Treasurer's Office might have some concerns. And as I mentioned, happy to work with anybody on anything they might want to tinker with in this bill. We're just looking for a structure that makes sense for Oregon based on the models we've seen in other states and to get this tool in the toolbox. Happy to work with anybody.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just again, so the ground upon which we are standing is clear, if we don't do this, then what happens? Because without the rules in place, again, in my business, we knew that there was always bankruptcy. That was the baseline. And we knew it was there, and many times we would make sure we got there, because the rules of how we unwound the whole crazy thing were then clear. That space in between, a very uncomfortable space, a lot of running around, a lot of enormous amount of litigation, grabbing the courthouse, selling it. I mean, that's my vision, grabbing the fire truck, selling it. I mean, running, chasing down, I mean, crazy times. What you then do is you run out and try to set up a receivership, which is what you kind of have done here with this device. But the key for everybody to understand that hasn't been through that is what happens without this. That's the most important part as I listen to the great presentation. But you've got to tell everybody what the alternative is, because none of it's good.
And the receivership option, what can the receiver do?
Not much.
I mean, really, here. Because the receiver... is a function of a state court, and again you run into the issue of the receiver has no leverage vis-a-vis its creditors. It can't impair. It can certainly work with creditors to impair, you know, to renegotiate terms going forward, but not deal with debts going backwards.
I'm reading section 3. And it appears that Section 3 gives the emergency Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board the authority to recommend may, on behalf of the local board, file a petition. Oh, I see. So the Fiscal Emergency Board actually has the authority to file a petition seeking for municipal bankruptcy under this bill in Section 3. I finally parsed the language. They don't have to go back to the board and say, board, we recommend you do this. They can do it on behalf of the board without the board of the government body actually acting. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And just to be clear, the board can set up sort of, you know, have bylaws and
so and one of the ways I could interpret this bill is simply that this is the way the state of Oregon would choose then to allow subdivisions other than the two you mentioned to exercise their capacity to go to bankruptcy court.
That's correct.
All right. How is this different from Michigan? I don't know anything much about Michigan oversight, receivership, whatever it's called, law, but I do know that local governments in Michigan, Flint and Detroit, hate it because the governor has established a czar who runs the place. How's this different?
We modeled this on a different model, essentially, where you don't have the governor appointing essentially a receiver to come in and make unilateral decisions. I don't want in any way suggest that the person appointed in Michigan did not do, or in Detroit did not do a good job under the circumstances, but there are really two models out there. One is the board model, and the other is the receiver model. And, you know, I think the receiver model has capture concerns, you know, who you appoint.
And who uses the board model? Several states?
Yes.
Other questions? I have a couple more witnesses I'd like to get to before we adjourn. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the explanation. Now let's hear from Chelsea Brossard and Wendy Johnson, please. Treasury and then cities. And I apologize. I've only allowed you about 7 or 8 minutes, but hopefully you can make the key points you need to make in that time.
Yes. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Brossard. I'm with the Oregon State Treasury.
I am here just to talk really briefly, and I'll make my testimony brief. If the bill is moving forward, we do have some concerns and would want to work on the language related to the state bond guarantee program. And I apologize, the director of our debt management division is at an Oregon Facilities Authority meeting today, so couldn't be here herself to answer any of the more technical questions that I know she'd be very ready and willing to answer and very equipped to do so. But I just wanted to be here to sort of to state that that is a concern for us, and we're a little unsure about how it would affect that program right now, and would want to work on the language with the proponents of the bill.
So you'd like to propose some amendments once you've had a chance to look at it a bit?
Yes, Chair Barnhart.
Please. Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I think a little like the treasurer, we haven't really reviewed this bill with a high degree of care. It's complex. It would totally rewrite how local governments handle fiscal distress, so, and it applies to all of our cities. But I want to make a couple of points that I can say before the specific language is the part that I just can't comment on. I think there's a lot of vague language in here that if the goal is efficiency and no litigation, I don't think we're there, because there's just too many vague phrases and words here that haven't been really vetted. But I think the issue is that we want to prevent this kind of fiscal distress, not give the pathway of how to, if you are in distress, how to get out, because we're dealing with counties, in our opinion, that haven't been making great choices with their property tax votes and things, and we don't have standards for what the responsibility is for a county. That seems to be one of the big problems, whether it's public safety or whether it's assessment and taxation. We don't have a standard baseline. So, for example, on page one of the bill, on line 17 through 20, it says one of the fiscal distress issues is that you can't provide minimally adequate services for something that's statutorily required. Well, nobody really knows what the statutory requirements are for assessment and taxation. So this bill would say, oh, the local government gets to decide whether they're providing fiscally minimum services. And I think our school districts and cities would disagree with what that looks like when it comes to how they're doing their assessment job. But this bill just gives that local government the decision, and then if they're not, they can go through this process. And that's not dealing with the real problem of, okay, so what is the county responsibility, and how do we make sure that they're held accountable? And this doesn't deal with it at all. The bill that did pass in 13, rather, that was the public safety provision. That one said, if you're going to go through this process, 50% of it still isn't going to be on the county's dime, and the rest the state will handle if you enter into this agreement. So we knew who had to do what, and you had to impose, you had to pay for the rest of it with taxes and things. So at least there was still responsibility. The fear that we have is, with this bill, is it takes away that responsibility, and we just have not vetted that process well. The Oregon Constitution, Article 11, Section 8, says that states are not to assume the debts of cities and counties. That's in our Constitution now, and this would be an exception to that. Potentially, I understand what Oren is saying, is that it doesn't really shift liability, but, well, how is that going to work in practical terms? We're just not sure. And I understand we're in the minority, but the last time I counted, there were 27 states, so there's still a whole lot of states that have not given up that authority to the states, have not provided to local governments to declare bankruptcy. And so, and those states that have, it's pretty tight details to get there. And so I'm just not sure we're ready this session. We'd be happy to work with the counties and special districts to make sure we get the right process right. I think we need a process, but I'm just not sure that this is it.
Sure. Let me ask a specific question, and I may want to ask AOC this question too, probably should have earlier. What is there a situation, and I don't want you to name it if there is there a situation that you are aware of today that might lead to the need for this kind of authority between now and the middle of March of 2018?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm not aware of the county finance system. I think that would be a better
question
for AOC.
He's coming back. He's going to tell us what his thoughts are on this question. I'm simply working on the issue of how much time we have. Are we in a place now where we're in big trouble with somewhere, or is this something that's looking at possible contingencies down the road?
Chair Barnhart, I believe we're there. I believe we're there in a number of communities, a number of our members, and you didn't ask me to name them, so I won't. But I can think of at least three that are virtually there, which is why we started this process a couple of years ago to try to get something on the books to deal with this. So, yeah, we can punt this down.
So you're talking about dealing with the issue that led to the 13 bill?
No, but those are more exacerbated now, Mr.
Right.
Chair,
and
because
you.
Of the loss of federal funding. So we have members that are virtually in need of this now. We can definitely punt it, but I prefer not to, obviously.
Thank you. Representative Bueller, you had a different question than Representative Smith?
Yeah, a couple
Please,
of
questions. Please, go
ahead. Sure. So are you saying a couple counties? Are there other entities that are also at peril right now?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, I'm only aware of our members. I'm not personally aware of any special districts or cities that are in the situation that a small handful of our members are in.
Can I direct that question to your colleague?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, I'm not aware of any cities that are in that situation. And I guess my question back to my colleague would be, if we do an extension on the public safety provision that's in that other bill and is the Dash 1 amendments, that's the primary responsibility, as I understand it, of counties, is to provide public safety. So if we extend that provision, will that address the distress of those two affected counties? Or do we need this extra tool that is so broad and doesn't have the other part of it, the stick, if you will, that you have to do these, you're responsible for this part of it? That would be my question.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. A slightly different question. So thanks, everyone, for educating me on this topic. It's very important and very complex. And I think I'm understanding that legally the state of Oregon would not have to assume those liabilities.
Right.
At least that's my understanding right now. But that means we could theoretically have what's termed zombie, either counties or cities, where functionally we have problems with safety, educating of kids, of maintaining health of certain areas. In maybe in legal terms, the state of Oregon wouldn't have to assume those liabilities, but certainly in political terms, I think there would be great pressure for the state to assume those liabilities. Maybe not a question, but I think it's something we all need to think deeply about and keep this topic at top of mind.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, I would just add that there's a requirement to have a county, but you can always dissolve a city. There's no requirement to have a city. And so these are different issues to keep in mind of what, and that's where I go back to, what is the minimal adequate services that the county is supposed to provide? Because if it's not the county, then what is left other than the state? And this bill still doesn't tell you what to do once you've declared bankruptcy and gone through the process. You're just dealing with the debt then. How do you deal with the services that are supposed to go forward? This bill doesn't address that.
Nor does current Oregon statute.
Representative Smith?
I just want to point out this is a complicated issue, and I think it would require much more conversation. If you recall back to one of the bullet points, it talked about our ability to issue debt. Well, as soon as you issue debt, you do assume the liability.
Sure. Yeah.
Because if the terms of that agreement don't, if they're not met, the state now has to exercise control and collect those dollars.
If we're a party to the indenture.
If we're a party to it.
To the indenture. Correct. If we're not, then we don't.
I just don't know who else.
Thank you. Let me suggest this, that the cities and the counties and the state treasurer get together, pursue the amendments that you think you need. If you can get back to us within the next couple of weeks, because that's about all the time we have, then we'd consider it. I'm inclined otherwise to say go away, work on it, and come back in time for a bill for 18. The reason I said mid-March is because that's when that next session will adjourn, is mid-March. I would just a couple of quick comments. I was on a task force, I think Representative Benson may have been too, where we worked on this issue and we ended up with the other bill in 2013, and it was kind of a small response to a big issue. This is complicated and difficult, and there are lots of issues to be dealt with. One other quick comment: in my district is a fire district, which merged with another fire district, And the result of that was a lot of people were unhappy about the fact that they no longer had their own fire district, and they decided they weren't going to pass the levy to keep the fire district operating. My response at that point was to introduce a bill to dissolve the fire district and reestablish the two old fire districts, and that got them angry enough at me that they decided to pass the tax and go on with operating the fire district. There are ways of managing these things that that may actually work other than bankruptcy, and for some cases, an outcome that involves the forgiveness of debt may not be the right solution at all. It may in fact be a much better solution to tell us to have the taxpayers, the voters, recognize what the outcome is if they don't decide to pay for the basic services that they enjoy. So anyway, I appreciate it. We are going to carry over. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2086, and colleagues, we're going to carry over until tomorrow the public hearing on House Bill 3453. Paul, have I done it?
You've done it.
All right, thank you. And with that, committee is adjourned. Before I drop the gavel, we're meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30 with the senators in the new joint committee, mm-hmm. 8:30 right here. See you then. And we also will be meeting tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock to deal with the bill I just set over and the things that are on tomorrow's agenda. Thank you. Committee's adjourned.